we have to be very, very careful. What we're talking is not so much democracy, we're talking organised hypocrisy. Hard facts.
Briefly, Kensington has spoken. Woo!
I have just been to see Her Majesty the Queen, and I will now form a government. A government that can provide certainty and lead Britain forward at this critical time for our country.
Listen, is it credible that with all the issues facing our country, all the issues of inequality and justice and the Brexit talks and everything else, that you have a government that cannot actually gain a majority in the House of Commons except by doing a deal with a very socially conservative DUP? Come on, we need something more responsible than that.
In words that could pass for a concise summation of the political fortunes of Jeremy Corbyn, none other than Mahatma Gandhi said that first they ignore you, then they laugh at you, then they fight you, then you win. A man who spent the best part of his 3.5 decades in politics in near total obscurity, the leader of the UK Labour Party confounded all the opinion pollsters, pundits and even his own parliamentary party in leading Labour to its largest ever share of the vote in any general election since 1945. And when you consider what Corbyn's been through since first being elected leader of the party in 2015, followed by his re-election after an intra-party leadership challenge in 2016, you have to admire the grit and inner strength he possesses, belying his avuncular and phlegmatic exterior. In the course of this election campaign, the British establishment and its media cohorts threw everything at Jeremy Corbyn, to the point where if you just arrived in the UK from another planet over the past month or so, you would have been forgiving for believing that Corbyn was an amalgam of Carlos the Jackal, Osama bin Laden and al-Baghdadi. Yet despite all of that, people, particularly young people, flocked to the polls to give them their vote on June 8th. And though he may not have won, at least not on this occasion, he succeeded in denying Prime Minister Theresa May the enhanced mandate she and her supporters and the establishment media believed was hers as if by right, before going into the country's crucial Brexit negotiations with the EU. Those negotiations have now been pitched into crisis, along with Theresa May's leadership, as the political momentum shifts decisively behind Corbyn as another general election appears inevitable. Jeremy Corbyn, like his US counterpart Bernie Sanders, is a democratic socialist. He is a man who believes that the economy should be a servant of the needs of working people, in other words, the vast majority of the population, rather than a tyrant to be served. He abhors poverty and social exclusion not only on moral grounds, but also because of the monstrous waste of human potential it describes, condemning its victims to lives of despair, hopelessness and immiseration. He rejects the idea, fomented in service to the god of neoliberalism, that compassion is a weakness and cruelty a virtue, that purifying people with pain of benefit sanctions, homelessness, food banks and low pay is consonant with anything other than moral sickness. These are the reasons for the surge in support for Jeremy Corbyn, whose manifesto for government offered the British people a vision of society driven by the politics of solidarity rather than cynicism and fear. So yes, the result of this has been to deepen rather than lessen the political crisis at the heart of Westminster. However, it would be a mistake to take this crisis in isolation. Raising our heads, we cannot but place it in the context of a wider political crisis that is underway throughout the West, specifically in Europe and the US, one symptomatic of a crisis within the economic model of neoliberalism. On the back of the 2007-2008 global economic crash and the ensuing austerity policies followed by governments across the West, the centre ground has collapsed, with the political space opening up now being contested between the ideologically driven right and left in a battle for the right to shape the future. With this in mind, the key question going forward is this: who will win this battle and what kind of future will be shaped? I'm John White and this is Hard Facts. Well, Tommy Sheridan is no stranger to anti-establishment politics. He is a lifelong socialist and he joins me now. Tommy, welcome to the show.
Thanks, John.
Now, you gave analysis of this election result for another media organisation, and you said something that really resonated with me. You described it as being, in part, a victory for social media over corporate media. Please elaborate on that. What exactly did you mean?
Thanks, John. Yeah, I think it is important to make the point that, in part, because the victory for Corbyn, as you've suggested so far, has got many facets. But one of those facets has to be the fact that the British establishment, in its most vile form via the tabloid media and the broadcast media, the British Bias Corporation, as most people now refer to them, they unleashed the dogs of hell against Jeremy Corbyn. They tried to demonise this man. They tried to have us believe that he was next door to a terrorist. He was a terrorist sympathiser, but at the same time, he was a bungling professor. They had no confidence in this man. This man wasn't the polished article. This man didn't have the soundbite at the ready the way some of the well-suited brigade have. And therefore, on the one hand, you can't trust him, and on the other hand, he's not competent. And what happened was there was a massive offensive on social media, on the Facebook, on the Twitter, a massive offensive said, wait a wee minute, so this guy would hesitate about pushing the nuclear button. Great! We want somebody who would hesitate about pushing the nuclear button.
That was one of the most remarkable aspects of this campaign. We actually had Defence Secretary Michael Falling boasting that Theresa May, in the right circumstances, would launch a first strike nuclear attack. I mean, it plunged the political class into complete disrepute, didn't it?
John, I watched the Question Time programme that took place from Yorkshire, where Jeremy Corbyn was effectively bayoneted by an audience that seemed to be swimming in other people's blood, yeah, as they were calling for Mr. Corbyn to say without doubt that he would press the button, he would press the button, he would press the button. Now, it now turns out, we found out via social media investigation, that most of them were former Tory candidates, yeah, but they were somehow or other just on this programme, not declared Tory candidates, just as the public, my ass, is the truth of the matter. What one woman said in that show, which spoke for millions,
she punctured the whole
atmosphere. She said, I simply can't believe that we are so keen and willing to kill millions of innocent people, including children, because that's what pushing the button is all about. And thank goodness that we have a man who says, no, actually, I'm not happy about it, and I would hesitate about it. And the truth is, he was uncomfortable because he doesn't even support his party's position. His party's position is to renew Trident. He knows that it's £200 billion worth wasted expenditure on effectively scrap metal, because it never will be used. If it is ever used, the planet's over, for goodness
and
sakes.
It's just worth making this point. This is not an independent nuclear deterrent, as is claimed. It's a US deterrent. The British establishment would need to get permission from the Americans before they could use it. They were built in America. The target codes are inputted in the States. So, I mean, all this nonsense about this kind of Britain being this kind of major power, you know, it's a US vassal, and Trident is symbolic of that.
Absolutely.
Status as a US vassal. But moving forward, you know, the crisis into which this election, I mean, when you think that it's 7 weeks ago when Theresa May called for the snap election, which she didn't need to call, everybody knows that, she did have a mandate, she had a parliamentary majority, she expected to waltz back into Downing Street with an enhanced majority. The Conservatives were 20 points ahead in the polls, and her, on a personal level, was even further ahead in the polls vis-a-vis Jeremy Corbyn. Something remarkable happened in the course of this campaign, Tommy, and I think it was the manifesto.
I think the manifesto had a huge part to play, John, but I also think there is masses of untapped potential out there. There are masses of people who, quite frankly, don't give a damn what the pundits say. You look at these shows, the BBC shows in particular, the other political talk shows, who is it that's on them? It's a small coterie of very higher middle class, well-paid, well-cosseted, well-comforted people who speak through a prism that they all share wine with and they all discuss and titter about. about. The truth of the matter is they're out of touch
detached
with the reality of ordinary people's lives. And what Jeremy Corbyn did in a brilliant fashion is he ignored all of that
went down
to speak to ordinary people at a street level. Those rallies that were held, I kept tweeting about this when people were saying he had no chance. I said, see, if he's no chance, why are 10,000 people turning up in Birmingham? Why are 10,000 people turning up in Reading? Why are thousands being locked out of every single rally that he holds? He's having to have overspill rallies. These things are real. These are real people with real votes and real voices and real families and real friends. They're speaking to one another. So it wasn't hard to see this subterranean revolution developing over the last 7 weeks. And I would go further and say it wasn't even just over the last 7 weeks. You mentioned earlier his second election campaign, the 2016 election campaign. It was an absolute lesson in political organisation. Look at how many people flocked and joined the Labour Party. Why? Because they wanted to vote for Jeremy Corbyn. I've got a solicitor, as you know. I'm involved in a lot of court issues and ongoing cases. And my solicitor shares a lot of my political views. He's maybe a wee bit more anarchistic than me. But my solicitor said to me one day, he phoned me up and says, Tommy, I thought I'd just let you know, because he's a big supporter of independence and he knows that I'm involved in a left-wing party called Solidarity. And he phoned me up and said, I wanted you to be the first to know, me and Liz, his partner, who's also a lawyer, we've just joined the Labour Party. And I said, brilliant, Gordon. He said, I want to vote for Corbyn. And to me, that was just one wee anecdote of thousands of people across Britain who I think have been waiting for a leader who actually encapsulated, see the point, the things you were making, compassion, belief in humanity, the idea of equality, of justice, redistribution of wealth, for been crying out for somebody politically to say, no, it's not acceptable that the rich get richer and the poor get poorer. It's not acceptable that you turn on your electricity switch and you make money for some private bloody shareholder.
One in four children in poverty, the highest rate of pension or poverty in the entire Europe, including Siberia, official. But it's not just a moral cause, this, Tommy. And this is a case that you've been making throughout your political life regarding socialism. It makes perfect economic sense. If you consider austerity, austerity has destroyed the purchasing power of millions of consumers or potential consumers, specifically working class and poor people, to the point where it's sucked demand out of the economy. The private sector is not investing, therefore tax revenues have gone down. The deficit's higher in the UK now than it is in Greece. The national debt has doubled. So even in its own terms, austerity has failed. Any economist worth his salt will tell you that you need to spend your way out of a recession. You need to reintroduce demand into the economy, because businesses don't create jobs, Tommy, as you know. Businessmen don't create, consumers create jobs by spending in the economy. So it comes down to this point. See, these people are not stupid, these Tories, Tommy. We know that. They know what they're doing. So why have they progressed with this programme when they know? And this is what I think, because it's greed.
Well, that's
it's, they're class warriors.
You've just answered your own question, because that's what I was going to say. That's exactly what austerity is about, John. The definition of austerity is to punish the poor for the crimes of the rich.
Yes.
That's the reality of it. And you are so spot on here, because at the end of the day, austerity and the austerity programme is morally redundant, but it's economically incompetent. Because what you have, and you don't need a degree to work this out, but I was fortunate enough to go to Stirling University way back in the 1981 when we got grants to go to university, and it was still free to go to university. That's when working class kids like me.
A utopia compared to now.
Yes, exactly. We used to march against Thatcher because she was going to cut the grant, and then Tony Blair came in and he never just cut the grant, he actually introduced fees. That's how far Labour had moved to the right. But in those days, I studied an economics and politics joint honours degree, and I always remember picking up this wee snippet from economics called The Marginal Propensity to Consume.
Yeah.
Now, it's a mouthful, but what does it mean, John? You and I know what it means. It means that if you give a rich person an extra tenner a week, they spend none of it. They put it in the bank because they've already got more than enough to live on. Whereas if you give a low-paid worker an extra tenner a week, they'll spend the tenner a week, and they'll spend it on local goods and services, so they'll increase the demand in the economy. And if you multiply that 10 million
effect.
Times
yeah.
over, and all of these people are spending their
That's
extra
your
tenner
economic
a week,
base right there.
There's your economic case yeah. for investment in public services and in public work service mm-hmm. workers. I have an absolute moral crusade, John. And it's a crusade that I raised during the independence referendum when I talked about the type of Scotland I wanted. I wanted to remove from the English dictionary a term which is sneaked in and is there now like a poisonous, horrible sore. And it's the idea of the working poor. Mm-hmm. The working poor.
It should be an oxymoron.
If you're bloody working, why are you poor? It is completely and utterly unacceptable. Let's get rid of it from the English dictionary. Every single person in employment should have a decent living wage, which means they can have a higher standard of living.
After the break, we're going to go more into what they've done in regards to attacking poor people, working people, and how they've criminalised poverty. Join us after this. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back. Hard Facts. Welcome back to the second half of this episode of Hard Facts. I'm sitting down with Tommy Sheridan. We are discussing the result, the seismic result of the UK general election and attendant fallout. And Tommy, you talked very passionately, as you always do, about poverty there. Now, I think it is a crime. If any other demographic was being attacked in the way that the poor have been attacked under this government, whether it be Muslims, whether it be women, whether it be black people, whatever, they'd be up in the international criminal. It'd be a human rights violation. But for some reason, when it's a working class, it's a class being attacked, it's acceptable. It's considered to make, there's no alternative other than to attack. And the way that they've shifted the paradigm when it comes to poverty, if you remember the 1945, the last time there was a real left-wing, transformative, redistributive Labour manifesto that brought us a welfare state, the NHS, and I'd like to talk about the NHS in a bit. This was based on the understanding that people who are poor or find themselves without work, they're the victim of circumstances out with their control due to the cyclical nature of capitalism. That's been shifted under the Tories and successive Labour governments, starting with Tony Blair, much to his eternal shame. Whereas the poor are blamed for their own poverty. It's a character deficiency. It's a moral deficiency. Now, that campaign has been hugely successful. I mean, to the point where callous cruelty is the norm. That's the norm in politics. That's not something to be punished. To be a sociopath is to be successful in politics nowadays, as it is in business. Here comes Corbyn. Even though they've mounted such a huge campaign, especially young people, they've not bought it. Because there's a connectedness, Tommy, with us as human beings. We're social animals. We can't walk past people who are suffering without feeling that pang of conscience. Nobody can if you're a proper human being, unless you've lost all humanity. And that, Corbyn was the lightning rod for that.
Definitely.
We discussed before we came on how he became Labour leader by accident. Because when he got on the ballot in the process of Labour election leader, he needed 30 nominations from his fellow MPs. Only about 10 really supported him. The rest did it because, oh, we feel sorry for him. We'll put the socialist on and let him have his little say, and then we'll go back to business as usual. That accident, which you find throughout history, has produced a seismic change in politics and consciousness in this country.
Incredible.
Talk about the inherent cruelty of the Tories. I'm minded of the great quote by Nye Bevan, the great Nye Bevan, who was a man who rolled out the NHS. No amount of cajolery, no attempts at social ethical seduction can eradicate from my heart a deep burning hatred of the Tory party. So far as I am concerned, they are lower than vermin. Now that's coming from Nye Bevan. But he was relating to the 1930s when he grew up and people were starving during the Depression under a Tory government. Because you've got a long history fighting the Tories. What drives these people, Tommy?
John, the great Tony Benn, whom your listeners may have heard of, was a giant of the left, the socialist left within the Labour Party. And he was a very, very good friend of Jeremy Corbyn. He's no longer with us, Tony.
He's his mentor.
Died a few years ago. And Jeremy has often talked about how Tony Benn was his political inspiration and his mentor, as he was with me, I've got to say. I joined the Labour Party. I'm 53 years of age now. I joined the Labour Party when I was 17, and I joined because of Tony Benn, because of what he was saying about war and peace and disarmament way back in the early 1980s. And Tony Benn said to me, one day. He said, "Tommy, we've got badges that have got Labour against the bomb, Labour against poverty, Labour against student cuts." He says, "When are we going to get a badge that says Labour against capitalism?" And you know, it summed up exactly what was wrong, because we were too busy fighting the symptoms of capitalism without actually fighting capitalism itself. Because, and along comes Jeremy, and he may use different terminology and he may use slightly different language, but when Jeremy says we are fighting against a system that is rigged, then what he is saying is we're fighting against capitalism, because capitalism needs poverty, needs inequality. It needs to drive worker against worker. It needs to drive community against community. It needs to have a small minority that are out of touch with everyone else, who live off the labours of the majority.
They rest on the bones of the workers.
Exactly, exactly. And Jeremy's come along and he's given life to the phrase, "Rise with your class, not on your class." He is actually putting socialism back into politics.
Solidarity.
And you know, it is having a mass resonance. These young people that we talk about, they're not polluted by the, "Oh, it doesn't work. Look at the Soviet Union. Look what happened in the past." They're not absolutely polluted by this this absolute defeatism, the cynicism, which was at the very root of the right wing of the Labour Party. Yeah. I mean, one of the things that I said post that election last week to rejoice about was the death of Blairism. Blairism's dead. It was a very, very vibrant force, unfortunately, within the Labour Party.
Triangulation, centres.
Corbyn has come along, and he said to all those Blairites who said, "Oh, you can never win, you're bungling, these policies are madcap." I'm sorry, but almost 13 million people voted for those policies. Yeah. That the highest since way back in 2001. So from that point of view, John, that there is so much that Jeremy encapsulates, but probably, and for many of your listeners, that they'll be able to associate this with the likes of Bernie Sanders in America as well. There is so much that he encapsulates, but one of the things that's probably primary is he means it. He actually means what he says.
Well, let's get into the personal quality that Jeremy brings, because, as you know, the individual is important in history. And it's a remarkable symmetry between him and Bernie Sanders. Both around the same age, a wealth of experience, unspun. They're not the usual confected, media-friendly, camera-friendly political huckster that we're used to. Tony Blair and all the rest of them, Ed Miliband and the Clintons and all that racket over in the States. There's an authenticity that people have latched onto, because people want truth. And they're tired of the lies, they're tired of the celebrity culture, they're tired of that celebrity culture coming into politics where it's a show, it's a game. It's not a game. It affects people's lives in a very, very real way. Now, Corbyn, I mentioned in my introduction, Tommy, I mean, he comes across as the most mild-mannered, avuncular figure you could ever hope to meet. The man's got steel running through his veins.
No,
what he's been through, you've been through that before. Attacked in every day in establishment media, depicted at first as the most inept, feckless, incompetent leader of the opposition there's ever been, then a terrorist sympathiser, unpatriotic, hates his country, the enemy within. We know the whole playbook of the right wing are being rolled out, and it's bounced off him. I mean, I think it's remarkable. What does this guy possess that has allowed him? Because a lesser figure who's still a strong figure in his own right would have resigned long before now under that kind of pressure. He kept his guns, he kept his vision, his team deserve great credit, and he weathered the storm, and look what's happened. What is it someone in that position has to possess to do what he's done?
Belief. He has to have belief in what he stands for. This guy isn't out for himself. This guy's out for his class. This guy is out for what he believes in. This guy is a socialist. This guy, who I met way back in 1989, when I travelled to Westminster to speak to what was known as the campaign group of MPs in those days. This was a group of left-wing MPs within the Labour Party way back then. And I was the elected leader of the anti-poll tax campaign. Some of your listeners may have heard of that from distant past under Mrs. Thatcher. And I went down to address the campaign group of Labour MPs to say, "Will you back us in a mass civil disobedience campaign?" Because at that time, we were left with no alternative but to call for non-payment of the poll tax, which was breaking the law. It was civil disobedience. And we went down and we spoke to the campaign group of MPs, because the mainstream Labour Party, the Kinnocks of the world, they'd completely and utterly written us off. And I met Jeremy, I met Tony Benn, I met Dennis Skinner, met Dave Nellis, all of these people. They were all 100% behind us, because they realised that they could afford the poll tax. They were well-paid MPs, but many of their constituents couldn't afford the poll tax. And in solidarity with them, they were willing to say they will refuse to pay and support others who are refusing to
pay. Put themselves on the firing line.
And that was a way back in 1989. Let's go from 1989 right up to 2017, and let's look at Jeremy Corbyn's political positions. Whether it's on apartheid,
every single issue.
Whether it's on the Iraq war, whether it's on the illegal invasion of Libya, whether it's on the destabilisation of Syria. This guy has been on the right side of the people all of the time. Maybe the wrong side of the law some of the times. You get arrested for his anti-apartheid activities. But while he was getting arrested for fighting against apartheid, people like Theresa May and his political opponents, they were actually fanfare and support of apartheid.
As young Tories at Oxford, they were wearing t-shirts, hang Mandela.
Hang Mandela. These people are out
David
of touch.
Cameron and all the rest
so
of them.
So from my point of view, he encapsulates, John, what I think is striking a chord, particularly with young people, and that is that they believe in him. He is not someone with a hidden agenda. He is someone who actually promotes socialism because he thinks it will make people's lives better.
He's in it
for
the right
everyone, not just for the poorest and not just for the richest, but for everyone. Remember, socialism is not about making everybody live in a downtrodden council house. Socialism is about
raising
giving
standards.
Everybody a better standard of life. It's about raising people up, not dragging people down. That's what socialism's all about.
And as we know, Tommy, in this world we live in today, there is more than enough to satisfy everybody's needs, but what there is not is enough to satisfy everybody's greed. You've been listening to Tommy Sheridan. I'm John White. Until next time, remember, the only facts worth taking seriously are hard facts.